This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Gourmet magazine set Ruth Reichel on her career path. She found the food publication when she was a young girl and quickly developed an interest in cooking, eventually became a food writer and editor working for the likes of the Los Angeles and New York Times. So you'd think when she got a chance to head the magazine that inspired her, she would jump at it. But at first she turned it down. Ultimately, she accepted the position as editor-in-chief of Gourmet and spent a decade at the head of that publication. Ruth Reichel is a food writer and the author of several books. Her latest is all about her time at Gourmet. It's called Save Me the Plums. And Ruth Reichel returns to The State of Things. Good to talk with you. How are you doing?
I'm great. It's good to be here.
So why don't we start right there and talk about that offer that you got initially and your initial reaction to the offer to become editor-in-chief of Gourmet.
Well, at the time, I was the restaurant critic of the New York Times, and I was a writer, not an editor. And I felt, you know, I had this deep connection to the magazine, which I'd been reading since I was 8. And I thought that someone who really knew what she was doing should take over the magazine and turn it into the best Epicurean magazine in the world, or try. And I didn't think I was that person. I had never managed a group of people. I mean, 65 people. I knew nothing about budgets or anything really about how magazines were made. I was a newspaper writer. And so, you know, I looked at them and said, I think you're really crazy to offer me this job, and go find someone who knows what she's doing.
Eventually you repented and you took the job. What made you change your mind?
Well, Cy Newhouse, who was the owner of Condé Nast, said that he really wanted to make Gourmet the finest Epicurean publication that it could possibly be, and that he was convinced that I could do it. And it was really tempting because it was such a moment in American food. It was 1999, and food was just becoming part of popular culture. And the idea of being able to make a magazine that reflected everything that I really believe about food, which is that it's much more important than just recipes and advice on where to go out to eat. And the notion that we could cover, you know, the American food system, which was starting to break down, and what was going on in farms and confinement animal facilities. And, you know, my whole feeling that food is really about everything and that eating is an ethical act. And he said, you know, you can do whatever you want. And in the end, it was just too tempting.
So you talk about and you write about in the book how you've seen our ideas about food change, mostly in the way in which, you know, you've given talks about this very thing, about our food infrastructure, and when eyes would at one point glaze over, things have changed very much now. Talk about that change that you've seen.
Well, I mean, for me, the most extraordinary moment is in 2006, I was asked to go speak to the conference of newspaper editorial writers. And I gave this really passionate speech about how they should please pay attention to food. And I talked about all the issues we were facing with the food system, overuse of antibiotics, pesticide runoff, you know, farmer suicide, on and on and on. And they didn't know any of it. They were stunned by what I was telling them. Well, 5 years later, they were covering all those things, and everybody in America knew about those topics. And more importantly than that, we had raised a generation of young people who really did care passionately about food in a way that no previous generation ever had, and were really looking, you know, making ethical choices about their food and understanding that, you know, how they spent their food dollars could have an impact on the economy. And suddenly, you know, restaurants, which had once been the province of mostly rich white people, were now kids were going to restaurants, young people were going to restaurants, people of color were spending money in restaurants. And it was an enormous change. It was like suddenly restaurants had become like the movies. A really important part of the popular culture that we all participate in. And I have to tell you that when I first started writing about food 50 years ago, I could never have imagined that the landscape would change so much.
Now, the question still remains whether or not a food magazine is the place for that kind of writing. In other words, would it work if you transformed the magazine? Was there resistance at first to this kind of transformation?
There was enormous resistance. I mean, for the first year, we just heard endlessly from devoted subscribers to the magazine saying how much they hated the changes. And I hand-wrote notes to every person who wrote to us and said, please stay with us. I know you love the magazine. I love the magazine too. I know change is difficult. Please keep writing to me. Tell me what you think. And gradually the letters changed. And the real aha moment for me when I knew that the audience was really ready for the magazine came in 2004 when we asked David Foster Wallace to write for us. And we sent him to the Maine Lobster Festival. And I never in my wildest imagination thought that he would end up writing a piece about what lobsters feel when they're going into the pot.
Now, tell us more about that piece, because as you say, you're thinking the Maine Lobster Festival, there's going to be lots of parsley and drawn butter here, but oh no.
No, I mean, he ended up writing, I mean, lobsters are one of the only foods that we bring alive into our kitchens and personally kill as we're cooking them. And he started from that and then wrote a beautifully reasoned, I think very important piece about the bioethics of eating living creatures. And he starts with lobsters and then expands it and actually says at one point, I doubt very much whether the readers of a culinary magazine want to consider these questions. And I looked at this piece, this brilliant, difficult piece, and I was terrified. I was just terrified. I was convinced that the readers of the magazine would, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people would write in and say, cancel my subscription.
And?
And instead, we had two people ask us to cancel their subscription. And literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people writing in to say how much they respected a magazine that would print an article like this. And, you know, one person said, you know, I will sign up for life. You have persuaded me that this magazine is essential reading. And I realized that that the audience would come with us wherever we were going, that they were hungry for real information. And what I had said to David Foster Wallace, who wanted a lot of changes, I wanted a lot of changes, and he was very reluctant to make the changes. And at one point, he said he would pull the article. And I said, you can do that. You know, anybody would be happy to publish this. It's really a brilliant piece of writing. And you could take it to The New Yorker or to Harper's or to The Atlantic. But you don't want to do that because you really want this, the readers of this magazine to read this. You want the people who are cooking the lobsters to be the ones who are reading this. And there was this long silence, and then he said, you're right.
And it does, the reaction to that, I mean, that was a keen insight or a brilliant stroke of, stroke of desperate reasoning on your part. But really, you're right on it in a sense, because There had been this change that you noted, that our relationship with food is far more complicated, that people who eat meat are thinking more deeply about what it means to take a life and how that life was treated before they got it. We do have a much more complicated relationship with our food just over the past 10 or 15 years, and apparently it's reflected in the response to that article.
Exactly. And it was really heartening. And from that moment on, I was, you know, really ready to take more chances and to take on issues of, you know, race and gender and, you know, to look at complicated issues like genetic modification from both sides, to have, you know, somebody write pro and somebody write con, and to really understand that we had people who were really looking for not just for food, but for food for thought.
Then there was the cupcake issue.
Yes.
Now that got a reaction.
That one was a real surprise to me. So we put a beautiful cake. It was a birthday cake for children that was covered with cupcakes. And it was colorful and bright and, you know, it was such a gorgeous photograph. We put it on the cover. And we started getting these responses from readers saying, that is the most disgusting cover you've ever... Somebody actually wrote in and said, I couldn't look at that. I had to tear the cover off because it was so disgusting. And I thought, they're cupcakes. What are they talking about? And we kept getting mail about it. And it finally hit me that we had unwittingly sent a message to the readers that what we were saying to the readers of what had once been a very elite group of people, you know, the gourmands, the gourmets of the world, who thought that the world of fine food belonged to them. And for them, cupcakes were children's food or plebeian food. They were, you know, they were the realm of Hostess and Snowball. And how dare we put something like that on the cover? And what we were saying is, you do not own this anymore. That food has become much bigger than your little gourmet world. And they got the message, even though none of us at Gourmet had really realized that that was the message we were sending. But they weren't wrong, because we were saying that. We were saying that food trends, which at one point had come from the tables of the king, from royalty, from the elite, down to the masses, were now working the other way, and that street food was now working its way into fine dining restaurants, which is exactly what has happened.
Well, tell us about your relationship. We've been talking about the change in the magazine, certainly change in American tastes and expectations, but take us back to when you were first smitten by that magazine and the influence it had on you. What was it that you saw in Gourmet as a young girl?
Well, I went with my father to a used bookstore, and my father was a book designer, and so he loved these stores, and he would take me along and sort of find a pile of magazines and leave me to read them while he prowled around. And one day he left me with a pile of very old gourmets. I mean, gourmets from the 40s, which had been, you know, written long before I was born. And I just happened. It was a piece of extraordinary good luck. On a piece called Night of Lobster by the poet laureate of Maine, who was actually a Pulitzer Prize winner and a beautiful writer. And he writes about rowing out with these lobster men and building this huge bonfire on an island and cooking these lobsters, and he describes eating them and the stars up above and the sound of the fish jumping in the ocean. And to me, it was like a fairy tale. And I realized that you didn't have to have magic to have extraordinary experiences. It was the first time that nonfiction had opened a door into another realm for me. And I became fascinated by food because it really hit me that I could pay attention to food, to what I was eating, to what I was hearing when I was eating, and that ordinary life would open up in a new way for me. And it literally changed my life, and I started reading Gourmet and actually paying attention to the sensory experiences of eating.
You know, all that you're talking about, and certainly the evolution of the magazine, and as I say, to some extent, the American public, although I would say an echelon within social strata, and this is really my question, is whether or not it is still very much class related. In other words, if we can think ethically about food, the cost now, and this has a lot to do with our farm policy and less to do with the actual cost of growing food. But are we still at a place where we can't fully enjoy and even indulge in the kinds of conversations that bring us to the table around questions of ethical eating?
Well, I mean, there's certainly a horrible thing that has happened in this country where we have developed a two-tier food system, where if you are a wealthy person, you can eat food that has been picked by angels and has never seen a pesticide. And if you are a poor person, you are relegated to eating stuff that's cheaper than food, basically, and that is not good for you. And that is something we all have to work very hard to change. And it is the next moment in food where we all demand that, you know, government policy towards, you know, what is taxed, you know, versus food. I mean, there is a reason why salads are more expensive than hamburgers. Mm-hmm. And that has to do with government policy. And we really need to understand what the social costs of our food policy are. And that's a very big issue, but it is the next issue on the table.
Ruth Reichel is a food writer and the author of several books. Her latest is called Save Me the Plums. Ruth, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. It's been really fun.
She will be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh tomorrow. It's a ticketed luncheon. Also going to be at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow night. And as always, we have the details of these events and readings at our website, stateofthings.org, where you can sign up for our newsletter and get a daily preview of our lineup. State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.